We now turn to the subject of organ donation after cardiac death. We have already noted this procedure or practice in an earlier discussion, but now is the opportunity to look at it a little more closely. One of the fundamental difficulties that is involved in this increasingly common practice is the fact, as I have highlighted in the text that begins the webpage, that one effectively has two different approaches being employed by people who are concerned with the end of life for an individual. The process of organ donation after cardiac death applies when a person is not brain dead, but has decided, or the person's surrogate decision makers have decided, that life support is going to be withdrawn from this individual. And so instead of withdrawing life support and then taking the patient a bit later down to the operating room for removal of organs, it all takes place in, as it were, a controlled environment. Life support is discontinued either in the intensive care unit or more commonly in an operating room, and after a period of time, and as we'll see, the protocols vary as to how long this period of time should be, organs may be removed after the person's heart has stopped beating for a specified period of time. The problem, of course, is that this means you have two very different teams of individuals working with this individual at the end of their life. The one, those who have been responsible for helping care for the person through the process of dying, concerned with the provision of palliative care for this individual, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the transplant team, which is concerned with maintaining the viability of the organs as much as possible. And so the transplant team, of course, would like to have, ideally or if possible, procedures begun even before death that will ensure that the organs are viable. And the question arises, is this appropriate for an individual who has not yet died? And we'll look at these in more detail as the section continues. What I've given you here are two different articles that occurred in the same issue of the New England Journal of Medicine in 2007, in July. The first is entitled Organ Donation After Cardiac Death. The second raises some questions about this practice and it is entitled The Boundaries of Organ Donation After Cardiac Death. Let's look at the first article first. It includes a paragraph that lists the issue of organ donation, which we've already noted before, and it includes a graph as well, highlighting the very great need for organs and the fact that, and the graph in the text that occurs below it highlights the fact that the most rapid increase in the rate of organ recovery from deceased persons has occurred in the category of donation after cardiac death, the subject that we're considering here. So it's of very great relevance in terms of providing the most significant number of significant increases in availability of organs for donation. And a second graph, a bar graph with explanation below it, points out that in dedicated institutions, there can be up to 20% of all deceased donors from this category, organ donation after cardiac death, that is, rather than organ donation after brain death. If we drop down below the charts to the highlighted text that begins obtaining organs, it reminds us that the approach of organ donation after cardiac death is what was done in the 1960s and earlier, but with the adoption in 1978 of the Harvard Medical School criteria for brain death, that has become the standard according to which organ donations were done up until the middle of the 2000s. So for nearly 40 years, the general practice was to receive donors who were brain dead. And now this question of donation after cardiac death has raised all kinds of issues while at the same time increasing the number of organs available. The article describes, if you drop down a little further, what we've already mentioned, that life-sustaining measures are withdrawn under controlled circumstances in the ICU or in the operating room, generally in the operating room, and that the time after withdrawal of life support and after the patient's heart stops beating asystole, that is, the heart is no longer beating, that the time after asystole until organ donation must be at least, and then there's a figure of time. Generally speaking, 5 minutes would be a good average for most protocols, but there are certain centers at which one allows the removal of organs 2 minutes after asystole. This would apply, as the text notes, most commonly kidneys and liver, but also pancreas, lungs, and in rare cases, hearts can be recovered in this fashion. And there's also the text highlighted that to avoid conflicts of interest, neither the surgeon who recovers the organs nor any of the other personnel involved in transplantation can participate in end-of-life care or the declaration of death. So one must have two completely separate teams, and the transplant team cannot begin its work until after declaration of death has been made. Now, again, note that there may be creeping desire to do things in order to preserve organs, which will be highlighted a little bit later on in this article. And the next section that's highlighted, that in about 20% of cases, despite the fact that life support is withdrawn, the person's heart does not stop beating, and if that does not happen within a period of time that is also specified in the protocols, then the individual cannot be a donor. They are returned to the room, and they presumably eventually expire there. The article goes on to highlight that there are individuals who are uncomfortable about participating in the question of organ donation after cardiac death. Number one, because of a concern of conflict of interest. If it's a large medical center, you may be counseling one set of patients to consider organ donation and another set of patients whom you hope might conceivably be recipients of the same organs. So the approach that you take may feel very conflicted. Other individuals have objected that the withdrawal of life support in the operating room with the expectation of imminent removal of organs changes the nature of the patient's death, which otherwise might involve family members present, members of the chaplaincy team, the offering of prayers for the dead, and so forth. So it certainly does change the context in which death takes place. And again, there's highlighted in red a reminder that according to the dead donor rule, organ donation should never cause or hasten death in any circumstances. And we will look in more detail at the scandal raised in San Luis Obispo. I'm in California, so I'm very much aware of that case in 2006. The transplant surgeon's name was Houghton Ruzrock, and there were some very grave charges leveled against him, and the case became rather celebrated and represents a kind of a powerful and painful reminder that under no circumstances may the transplant team ever be involved in end-of-life care, and certainly not in administering any drugs before the patient has been expired, particularly drugs that could hasten the patient's death. And if you drop down a little further, there's the expectation that typically potential donors are taken to the operating room while still living and with explicit consent. And here again, we saw that there are some organ procurement agencies that would argue that they don't think explicit consent is required, but nevertheless, in general, one is required to obtain specific consent for heparin and perhaps other drugs that are administered not to treat the person as they die, but instead to maintain organs. So this is not palliative care. It's the administration of something while the patient still lives that is directed towards maintaining their organs. And there's also mention in this article for protocols that call for the advanced placement of catheters in large arteries and veins to facilitate rapid infusion of organ preservative solutions after death. And again, this would be done before the patient expires and represents a question mark and a potential conflict of interest. And this issue of organ donation after cardiac death is not so much an option. Note that in the paragraph that begins in January of 2007, hospitals with necessary resources must develop donation policies in conjunction with staff and organ procurement organizations that address the, quote, opportunities for asystolic recovery of organs, which is organ donation after cardiac death, even if they don't implement it. However, if they choose to opt out, then in a certain sense they have to justify this. Notice the text highlighted in white that is in boldface and in black text. As of July 1st, 2007, there was a requirement that all 257 transplant hospitals and 58 organ procurement organizations in the U.S. comply with the rule that developing policies for this kind of practice must exist, although there is a possibility of an opt-out, which is progressively discouraged among institutions that do organ donation. Then the concluding part of this first article, and I've numbered it 1.1 in red text, elements of protocols for recovering organs after cardiac death, and there's a description in the quotation at the very bottom of this section describing the kinds of patients who would probably be considered candidates. That includes individuals with end-stage musculoskeletal disease, pulmonary disease, lung disease, and high spinal cord injury. Not the only ones, but these would in general be the patients who would be considered, who would be on life support, and whose organs would be regarded as largely recoverable. Then in the section marked donors, section 1.2, there is a description of both the involvement of the organ procurement organization and an assessment of whether it's likely that the patient will die rapidly after withdrawal of life support. Obviously, assembling a team to wait is only appropriate if it's likely that the patient will expire within a relatively short period of time. Then in section 1.3, in regard to consent and approval, one sees here that there is the expectation that consent will be obtained specifically for the things that might be done before the death of the patient, such as the placement of catheters for the infusion of solutions that would preserve the organs, and also the administration of heparin, and where appropriate, clearance from the medical examiner or coroner has to be obtained. Then in section number 1.4, a reminder that the organ transplant team cannot be present when life-sustaining measures are withdrawn, removal of the endotracheal tube or termination of medication for blood pressure support. They may not be involved in the administration of any end-of-life or palliative care or in the declaration of death. And as we'll see, this was the issue that arose in the case of Dr. Ruzrock. In section 1.5, a reminder that the pronouncing of death cannot be done by the transplant team. It must be done by the people who are caring for the patient. And then note in number 1.7, organ procurement should not result in any financial expenditure on the part of the donor's family. If we then move down to section 2, this second article, this particular author is highlighting what this author regards as problems in the area of organ donation after cardiac death, and is suggesting that the boundaries of ethically acceptable behavior may already have been crossed, or at least be suggested in certain protocols. And if you drop down to the text that is highlighted in red boldface text, donation after circulatory death has become mainstream, and now researchers have begun to design innovative protocols that aim to improve the function of transplants and expand the donor pool. These protocols test the conceptual limits of donation after circulatory death by, number one, permitting invasive intervention in living organ donors, or two, by altering the tests required to determine death. And the author refers to another article published in the same issue of the New England Journal. And we can perhaps skip the chart and look down to the next section that is highlighted in white with red text. The decision of a patient or surrogate to have life-sustaining therapy withheld should precede and remain independent of the decision to donate organs. This is a principle that we've already mentioned and that is highlighted here as well. They should be two separate decisions, and as we've already seen highlighted in the other article, the team that determines death must be strictly separated from the procurement team, and there's specific reference here to the case of Dr. Ruzrock, which we will be considering in our next section. And now we get to the author's real concern. The situation is complicated when a protocol permits intervention in the living donor through administration of heparin or vasodilators, medication that opens up the blood vessels, ensuring that oxygenation of the organs is taking place as much as possible, not to benefit the donor patient, but only to improve the function of transplantable organs. So there's an ethical question. You now have treatment being offered to the person while alive, which does not benefit them in any way during the process of their death, but is aimed solely at preserving the organs. And protocols, more invasive protocols that involve extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, that is to say heart-lung machines, are much more invasive, and they involve the insertion of arterial catheters, which we've already mentioned. That is to say, catheters here meaning metal tubes that are placed in the large blood vessels, primarily in the legs, to infuse into the bloodstream medications, substances that will preserve the organs. And here the author mentions a disagreement that the advocates of this procedure regard consent that sufficiently justifies these interventions because they're minimally harmful to the patient and they benefit the organ recipient, but opponents to this approach argue that respect for the dying patient is being compromised. While still dying, the patient is being prepared to become an organ donor in a way that opponents of this practice regard as damaging to the individual's dignity. And now the author turns, and this is highlighted in white with black text, the author turns to both the medical and the philosophical issues that are raised in these rather more invasive procedures. The author points out that the dead donor rule requires that the donor be dead before organs are procured. The first question, how long must the patient be without a heartbeat in order for it to be irreversible? That is to say, the notion is that after a certain number of minutes, after the heart has stopped beating for a certain number of minutes, the situation is irreversible and nothing could be done to restore the patient's heart to a normal beating state. Which is another way of saying that the patient can be described as definitively dead at that point. In one protocol, it's 5 minutes. In other circumstances, it's been pointed out that in certain circumstances, after as little as 65 seconds, there is no possibility of restoration of function, and so 5 minutes becomes a rather safe extreme limit. However, there was a protocol involving a pediatric patient who became a donor in which the interval of no heart beating before the patient was declared dead was not 5 minutes, but 75 seconds. That is to say, a minute and 15 seconds. And they did this based on research that 60 seconds was the longest reported duration of no heartbeat that had been followed by spontaneous restoration, auto resuscitation. And so the situation is not exactly as I hinted above, that nothing whatever could be done to restore the heart, because obviously if the heart is going to be donated, it has to be restarted. So what the protocols are primarily concerned with is, have we ever seen spontaneous resumption of heartbeat? And the idea would be that you wait until it is beyond the limit at which such resumption of heartbeat has ever taken place, at which organ donation could happen. And here we raise the very difficult point. And if we drop down to the paragraph that begins an unanswered question, the unanswered question is whether cardiac transplantation from a donor declared dead according to a circulatory criterion retroactively negates the determination of death. Or to put it in other terms, if the organ that you're going to remove is the heart, and the intention is that the heart is going to be restarted, then how can the person have been declared dead on the grounds that their heart had stopped beating? It stopped beating, but you intend to start it up again. So is it legitimate to use that criterion that it is stopped beating in one patient, then removed and started in another? What does that mean in terms of a definition of death? Does the fact that the donor's heart is restarted in another patient prove that circulatory cessation was not irreversible? Does that mean that, in fact, the idea of the imminent and then absolute reality of death is somehow negated by the fact that the organ can't be dead because, in fact, it's going to become alive in another person. This is rendered even more complex if one uses ECMO, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. If you're going to provide oxygenated blood to various organs, well, not only are the organs going to be preserved, but there isn't any way that you can say that there is irreversible loss of function because the device itself is going to prevent or would prevent the progress to brain destruction on the basis of no oxygenation of the brain. And so you now have the very difficult problem of, okay, if we're going to oxygenate the organs, well, we'll only oxygenate them from the neck down. We won't oxygenate the brain because the individual needs to progress to brain death if this is going to be the natural process of death. Well, you can see how very, very physiologically, ethically, and philosophically complex this question is becoming. And so the author concludes by asking the question, to what extent should society permit manipulation of an organ donor or alteration of the determination of human death for the good of organ recipients? And he makes a prediction that when prudent boundaries are created, they will exclude whole body extracorporeal membrane oxygenation of the donor and death determinations at 75 seconds. So the kinds of things that are being done now have not only tested the limits, but pushed them beyond what are acceptable limits. And if one doesn't step back from and stop using these protocols, the author is effectively predicting, although he doesn't say this, that there will be a backlash because people will point out that effectively you're no longer really requiring that the patient be dead, because effectively you're preserving everything except the patient's brain and doing so in a very highly artificial and invasive sort of way. So this gives us an indication of some of the thorny issues that are raised by organ donation after cardiac death, and I'm sure that as time goes by, they will continue to be highlighted and these issues will enter into the public forum more vigorously. And this provides us with an opportunity to look at a very clear example of a scandalous misuse of the protocols that occurred in 2007 with Dr. Houghton-Ruzerock, which will be the next section that we will cover.